en coloc. Une retransmission proposée par Canal Académie.
L'Académie des sciences organisait en septembre 2009 un colloque international consacré à la minéralogie environnementale. Les meilleurs experts français et étrangers sont revenus sur le concept récent de science de l'environnement à l'échelle moléculaire en s'appuyant sur de nombreux exemples en France et aux États-Unis. Canal Académie vous retransmet les interventions de 5 scientifiques, le tout en 2 parties. Dans ce premier volet, retrouvez les interventions de Laurent Charlet et de Karim Benzerara. Laurent Charlet est géochimiste de l'environnement au laboratoire de géophysique interne et technophysique de Grenoble. Il s'exprime sur la réactivité aux interfaces minérales solutions, processus redox et transport de l'arsenic dans l'environnement. Karim Benzerara, pour sa part, est chargé de recherche au CNRS, à l'Institut de minéralogie et de physique des milieux condensés. Son intervention porte sur les mécanismes et les conséquences environnementales des processus de biominéralisation microbienne. Ces deux interventions sont en anglais. Tout de suite, Laurent Charlet.
It's my pleasure to be here today with George Kallis and the rest of you to discuss a very exciting area of science that I think has been growing for some time and now is beginning to blossom into a major field in the earth sciences and bridging between other sciences as well. Also the interesting thing is that this topic of environmental mineralogy has broad aspects with, even within the earth sciences, overlapping many different fields within this area of science. So it's a pleasure to be here today. I hope that this meeting will be a stimulus for further meetings like this around the world. I just noticed in looking around this morning that there's one empty picture spot right up here. So one of you may end up there one of these days, I hope. Okay, first I'd like to acknowledge a number of very important collaborators that George and I have had over the years, and they're listed on this slide, both from the University of Paris 6 and 7, IMP, PMC, and also from Stanford University and a few other places that we collaborate with in the U.S. So I thought I would start off by talking briefly about the sources of natural contaminants. These are the minerals that occur, of course, at the Earth's surface, undergoing chemical and mechanical weathering, and also interactions with biological agents. And I've listed my top 10 most dangerous minerals here. This is just my opinion, of course, but you might say, why is hydroxyl apatite a dangerous mineral? Well, it precipitates in heart valves and kills people, so that makes it a fairly dangerous material. Arenite you might recognize as a zeolite that is well known to cause mesothelioma. I've listed K feldspar because it's one of the major sources of uranium in the Earth's crust. Pyrite, of course, is a very famous mineral. Everybody, even people who don't understand minerals, recognize pyrite, or sometimes called fool's gold, but it's one of the major sources of arsenic in various places, including Southeast Asia. Cinnabar and galena are the major sources of mercury and lead, and so on. So this is just to give you a brief introduction to natural contaminants coming from natural minerals. Then we move to anthropogenic contaminants relevant to environmental mineralogy, and there are many of those. We, of course, mine some of the minerals I just showed you, such as galena and cinnabar. We have various industries that produce pollutants of different types, a lot of heavy metals. There's high-level nuclear waste that we concentrate and then store in different places, and this is a major problem in the U.S. because the Yucca Mountain repository has just been deemed not acceptable by the Obama administration, so we're still looking for a place to store our nuclear waste. And then we have, of course, a lot of this stuff emitted into the atmosphere, and then it's deposited on the surface in water supplies. It gets into the groundwater table, and depending on the hydraulic gradients, it can travel great distances, spreading the contaminants in various ways that impact humans. One of the issues that we often face is scaling molecular scale information to the field scale, as shown here. These are field scale types of processes, and this is a very difficult thing to do, and perhaps one of the holy grails of this field of environmental mineralogy. But what is possible right now is to use the molecular scale information that we can derive from various measurements and experimental studies to identify important reactions and the products of those reactions, the spatial distribution and phase association, and the most likely reaction pathways and rates for different species. So that's one of the things we will focus on during this meeting. Now, some of the key issues that are present in the environment, in the field of environmental mineralogy, I've sort of listed here. If you've heard me talk before, you probably have seen me use this slide that I made up some years ago. But I love this picture. This is a picture of the Earth taken from the Apollo 17 mission. And what it shows very nicely is that the Earth is made up of interfaces between liquids and solids, between liquids and gases, and between gases and solids. And so one of the key issues that we all think about is that these contaminants that are generated by the various processes I've just talked about often interact with mineral surfaces, with organic matter, with microbial organisms and soils, and this shows the complexity of what we're dealing with. So this is an extremely complex set of problems that we have to, in many cases, break down into the simplest components in order to study them at a fundamental level, which is what many of us try to do. Speciation is a huge issue. What are the mineral species present? What are the heavy metal species present, either in groundwater or in the atmosphere or on mineral surfaces? Surface reactions, of course, are key to understanding a lot of the things that go on in the environment. Natural organic matter is also a key component that's not very well understood, not nearly as well understood as minerals, because this is even more complex than minerals because of the heterogeneous nature of natural organic matter. And then, to complicate matters even further, we have microbial organisms and biofilms and other things like algae that enter the picture that can also influence the way that the contaminants behave. And one of the hot areas in modern technology, I just came from a conference in Washington, D.C., over here directly. We had an important conference on the environmental implications of nanotechnology. So this just shows the importance of nanominerals and mineral nanoparticles in the environment. And this is a huge field that's growing day by day because of all the manufactured as well as incidental nanoparticles that are being generated anthropogenically, but we have to keep in mind that we have enormous numbers of nanoparticles that occur naturally as well. Okay, just to give you an idea of some of the nanoparticles that occur in the atmosphere, I went through the literature and made a list of the most important nanoparticles listed in the order of importance. So illite is the most abundant of the nanoparticles in the atmosphere. Gypsum is, these are all very important. There are many, many others as well. So here's hematite and iron oxide. Here's halite and many that you recognize. This is what we breathe. In fact, if you look at this quotation here, the last part of this is, these are estimates of the number of particles in the 0.1 to 0.01 micron size range in a remote area of continental air that is away from any immediate urban influences. And you see that we have something on the order of 300 million particles per cubic meter of air. So sitting in this room, we're breathing large numbers of nanoparticles as we sit here and think about this slide. In terms of total numbers of nanoparticles that are contributed by nature versus contributed by humans and human activities, you can see that there's about a factor of 7 greater introduction of nanoparticles from natural sources than from anthropogenic sources, at least right now. And that's changing, of course, very rapidly. This is just a picture from one of Peter Bisek's papers of some of the nanoparticles that are found in the atmosphere, the troposphere. So here's sulfate, calcium sulfate, a silicate, sodium chloride from sea salt spray, smectite, clay particles, goethite, and many, many others. But this is just a simple picture of some of the ones that, again, we might be breathing as we speak. Iron oxides, I've mentioned several times already, but these are extremely important in the environment. And you can see pictures of some of the places in the U.S. where iron oxides have played an important role. In Oak Ridge National Laboratory, these are some of the holding ponds where uranium was disposed of. And the orange-reddish-colored material here, of course, are iron oxides. This now, of course, is a parking lot. This is what we do in the U.S. to cover up our waste. So the cars are parked on this material right here. It's still there, by the way. And this is a very major remediation problem at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. I'll be talking in a minute about some of the mercury minerals and their biogeochemistry. This is one of the sites that we've done a lot of studies at in New Adria, California, major mercury mine, in fact, the second largest mercury mine in North America. And you all are familiar with Bangladesh and Southeast Asia and the arsenic poisoning problem there. So again, iron oxides, as you see here in this horizon, play a very, very important role in sequestering and then releasing arsenic into the environment and to the groundwater. So I'd like to start off my comments, the four topics I'm going to cover. We'll start with the mineralogy and microbiology of mercury in mining environments. It turns out in the Bay Area we have a huge problem with mercury. It's probably the most important environmental pollutant that we have. I've just listed, this is a very interesting table from Parsons and Percival published in 2005, listing all the different mercury minerals, plus a number of ones that have not even been named yet. So if you have a chance to work on these, you can actually name them for your favorite mineralogist, perhaps. But the ones in blue are the ones that we often find associated with mercury mining deposits, as you see here. The importance of this is that some of these are extremely soluble, things like montroidite, and therefore release ionic mercury to the environment where the mercury can be transformed into monomethylmercury by sulfate-reducing bacteria. Others like eglesonite and mercurochloride are also very soluble. And then we have minerals such as cinnabar and metacinnabar, the main ores of mercury, that are quite insoluble. I'll say something about elemental mercury. This is a very important player we're just discovering in many environmental settings involving mercury. So this is what the main ores of mercury look like. This is from New Idria, California, cinnabar, sometimes called strawberry ore. Here's cinnabar, here's some metacinnabar, marcasite. This is the mine itself, and I'm going to try to turn this light off if I can. Whoops. There. This is the mine that we're going to be looking at for a few minutes now. This is a 1910 photograph of the mine. This is 2007, so Christina Chismazu, who's sitting somewhere in the audience, took this picture. And here's an acid mine drainage pond. This is a waste pile containing lots of elemental mercury and also calcine material that's been roasted. The mine operated between 1854 and 1972. As I said before, it's the second largest mercury producer in North America. Just to show you some of the settings that we deal with here, this is a sort of a composite put together in another paper, but now we'll show some photographs. So there's a reservoir, this one right here, that has drinking water for the small town that used to be the mining town of the New Idria district, pH 10 water. And then we have the main adit. You see the water's coming out very high in hydrogen sulfide gases coming out of here, a little bit lower pH, 4 to 5. So drainage right out of the mine itself, and basically about 100 miles of tunnels underground are the hidden part of this mine that you don't see. The waste pile that we just saw, the furnace waste, is shown here. The settling pond is an acid mine drainage pond from the breakdown of marcasite and pyrite, low pH. You see these very interesting sort of films on the water. Those are biofilms. Microbial biofilms are very typical here. These are salts sulfate salts, typically of magnesium, because this is a serpentinite area. But the biofilms are playing a very important role here in terms of the breakdown of the cinnabar and metacinnabar. This is where two of the waters come together. This is from the drainage pond interacting with water that's pH 9, so this now becomes neutralized up around pH of 7. The mine tailings, these are the calcine piles. And then finally, the creek that drains from this area is San Carlos Creek with pH 7. The orange material that you see here is all mostly ferry hydrate, an iron hydroxide. We'll talk more about that later, too. If we look at some of the particulate matter that comes out of these tailings, we find nanoparticles of various types. Here are some of the ones we've looked at with transmission electron microscopy. Hematite, jarosite, we find aluminosilicate gels, anatase, silica, and importantly, we find very small particles of cinnabar, mercuric sulfide. So one of the major findings in our studies of the mine waste is that the most likely way that mercury is transported from this mine to other sites is in the form of nanoparticles of cinnabar, mercuric sulfide. One of my students, Adam Ju, who could not be here, has done quite a bit of work with this microbial biofilm I showed you, and he carried out experiments in which he used solutions containing this microbial biofilm in contact with the mercuric sulfide, both cinnabar and metacinnabar, and the result of this is that he found that the solubility of cinnabar and metacinnabar, which, by the way, have very low solubility products, the solubility is increased by about 25 orders of magnitude by a species such as Thiamomonas intermedia at this site. So bacteria can have an enormous impact on the minerals and their solubility, helping the release of things like mercury into the environment in the form of HD2+. In terms of global emissions, mercury is, of course, very, very important. We're all impacted by this, by the various global types of emissions, including things like coal-fired power plants, which are becoming exceedingly important. In terms of energy in this country, not this country, but in the U.S., we derive about 50% of our electrical power from the burning of coal, which, of course, contains pyrite, and other mercury-containing materials such as organic matter, and that, of course, is emitted. And you can see now that we have more anthropogenic output of mercury than we have natural output, which is an unfortunate situation. In the Bay Area, we have a lot of mercury that's been released from mining practices, but including things like major oil refiners, which are releasing about 3,000 pounds of mercury emissions each year into the San Francisco Bay Area. So it's really a major problem in the Bay Area. So we started a project in which we're looking at the emission of mercury. We have field-deployed gauges here that we can actually measure mercury output from. We collect samples. We take them back into the laboratory. We look at the emissions under both field and lab conditions at constant temperature under both light and dark conditions. And we do what's called XF spectroscopy on the mercury to find out what are the major species that are present. One of the things that we were not able to do up until just recently is to look at mercury zero in these mine wastes, because it turns out that XF spectroscopy gives a very, very poor signal for mercury zero or liquid mercury because of the distorted nature of the material. So what we just have finished doing is developing a low-temperature technique and low-temperature experimental protocols for freezing the mercury. Turns out that the freezing temperature of alpha HGO or HG0 is minus 38.7 degrees centigrade. So by freezing it very slowly, we can produce alpha HG, which is shown by this red line here. We now have a very strong excess signal that we can analyze and look at. In the presence of other things here, you can see that that red signal is out of phase. Sorry, it's now blue. But it's out of phase with cinnabar and metacinnabar, so we can now easily look at a complex mine sample and pick out all of these phases in the same sample using this approach of XF spectroscopy. This shows a particular fit, and then here's some of the data. Don't worry about this, just so we can actually do what are called linear combination fits of the various mercury minerals that are present, including elemental mercury, in these various mine waste samples. And this just shows a table of some of the results so far. The purple show the high concentrations of mercury zero, which we couldn't see before, basically. And then if you look at the light-dark ratio, you see that we have much more mercury coming off under light conditions when we have high concentrations of mercury zero mixed with things like cinnabar and metacinnabar. If we plot these data up, as shown here, this is a plot of mercury flux versus total mercury. It makes no sense whatsoever. But if you now look at the mercury flux versus percent elemental mercury, there are two trends that we see, and we have to have, of course, to collect much more data to make these trends believable, but these are hot springs type deposits here. These are silica carbonate deposits here. So we now have a nice correlation between the mercury flux given off into the atmosphere from these mining waste versus percent elemental mercury. Moving on to ferrihydrite nanoparticles and acid mine drainage systems. I mentioned this before and showed you the system. This is one of the projects that Christina Chismazu is working on. She's here and she'll have a poster this evening to show you more about this. One of the things that I suggested to her when she first became my student was that ferrihydrite should be something similar to meghemite, gamma Fe2O3, because of similar structures. It turns out I was wrong. It's not, as I'll show you now. So what we've done is we've started doing what's called total X-ray scattering at high energies using the advanced photon source. We use X-rays that are 90,000 electron volts, very, very penetrating. We can have high 2-theta ranges or Q ranges of data. When we Fourier transform those, we get very high-resolution G of R functions, as shown here, from which we can pick out various pair correlations as shown around the periphery of this image. We've carried out studies that have now followed up on Mark Michel's classic study. This was his study for the PhD degree at Stony Brook University. Mark is now in my group at Stanford. This was a structure that he proposed for ferrihydrite. This has turned out to be quite a controversial structure. One of the problems was that when you look at the refined formula, it doesn't have nearly enough protons in it. We know there's much more water in this material than shown there. But there were really a lot of doubts about whether the structure was valid at all. And these are some of the fits that he did in real space. So what we've done since he joined my group at Stanford, we've carried out some studies in which we've looked at the aging of synthetic so-called two-line ferrihydrate shown by the diffraction pattern here, in the presence of a citrate and a temperature of 175 degrees C, and you can see the changes that occur in the diffraction pattern and also in the magnetic properties of this material. And what I would like you to focus on here is this plot right here. This shows the abundance of the different phases we found. This is ferrihydrite, the two-line ferrihydrite. We find this new ordered form of ferrihydrite, which we call ferri-FH, and then, of course, this finally transforms into hematite over there, with increased aging over a period of roughly 14 hours, and again, in the presence of citrate. This just shows some of the fits. We did a chemometric analysis of these fits and found that there were three species that are needed to fit these data. Ferrihydrite, the ordered form here, which occurs after 8 hours of aging, and then ultimately hematite. And this shows some of the diffraction data over there. We tried fitting this with a maghemite model. As I mentioned before, I thought maghemite was a likely candidate for the structure of this. It turns out it's a very poor fit versus the original ferrihydrite structure that Mark proposed a couple of years ago. We also were able to, for the first time, work out detailed formulas based on thermal gravimetric analysis, that is weight loss of water, as well as total iron analyses, coupled with what we've also done on the structure. And you can see that the so-called two-line ferrihydrite has a formula that looks like something like that, whereas the ordered form looks something like this. I can talk with you later about this if you'd like to see this in more detail, because it's going to flash by very quickly, unfortunately. We found out, for example, that as the ordering occurs, the particles get larger in size. We also find that the strain, as measured by cell parameters, becomes less and less as we age the sample, and these particles become larger in dimension. One of the net results of this is that we find we can propose these sorts of structures now. The other thing about the ordered form of ferrihydrite is that all of the iron vacancies are now filled. We put in here the magnetic spin moments to show you various possibilities. This results in a magnetic moment of about 10 Bohr magnetons per Fermi unit. This one results in about 30 Bohr magnetons per Fermi unit. It turns out that the measured value is about 9 Bohr magnetons per Fermi unit. If you take into account spin canning at the surface of the nanoparticles, this fits this value over here pretty well. So we think this is the magnetic structure and the geometric structure of ferrihydrite. Both fit the data very well, but it was this aging in the presence of citrate that allowed us to see this much larger particle type of ferrihydrite and ultimately verify that this is the proper structure and the proper magnetic moments alignment. Now, moving on quickly to some of Christina's work, these are the natural samples that we collected at the same mine site that I've shown you now a couple of times. Here she is collecting ferrihydrite samples out of a stream at pH 7. What she's found is that these natural ferrihydrates contain lots of impurities. This just shows aluminum and silicon quite high, and a number of others as well. This is what they typically look like. They're highly aggregated nanoparticles. We've done some scanning transmission X-ray microscopy imaging of iron and aluminum and silicon of these materials. You can see a separate aluminum phase and probably a separate silicon phase, although it's not as clear as shown here. One of the other important things that Christina discovered is that you can use the Zanes microspectroscopy, and by the way, these Zanes spectra are taken at a spatial resolution of around 30 to 35 or 40 nanometers. So we can see, for example, micas that are present in the ferrihydrite, aluminum hydroxide, gel-like materials, clay minerals, and so forth. We've also done some NMR studies in Jonathan Sebbins' laboratory, and you might say, why would you want to do that on ferrihydrite? Because the line should be very broadened by the presence of iron. It turns out that if the aluminum nuclei are separated enough from the iron nuclei, then we get very sharp features, and we see both four as well as six coordinate aluminum in phases that are separate from the ferrihydrite. And that's saying that there's not a lot of aluminum in the ferrihydrite. There is, and it actually is silent aluminum. We can't see it with NMR, but if the aluminum-bearing phase is separate, forms a separate phase relative to the ferrihydrite, we can see very clear NMR signals. Silicon spectra look sort of all the same, roughly speaking. We see some mica, we see some quartz. We also did some carbon mapping. So this is a carbon map that Christina made at the Advanced Light Source at UC Berkeley. And one of the things that, one of the major take-home messages today is that carbon is really ubiquitous in these sorts of samples, and it must have an impact on the reactivity of these ferrihydrites. And again, if you map the carbon edge and do a simultaneous Zane spectroscopy, you see evidence for aromatic groups, you see evidence for aliphatic groups, as well as for carbonate ions in this mixture. We did total X-ray scattering, again, of the same sort that we've done on the synthetic ferrihydrites, and this is a comparison of the synthetic and the Nuidria ferrihydrite here. You can calculate the GFR functions and show the paracorrelations. This is what the diffraction pattern typically looks like, but when you take very high-angle data, you can get a nice resolution in your GFR function. This is Christina's summary of basically what's happening here. These are a series of ferrihydrites that she's prepared using different amounts of silicon in the samples, and you can see that the coherent scattering domain length becomes less and less and less, about 20 angstroms or 2 nanometers down here for pure ferrihydrite, only about 1 nanometer up here. So there's a real change caused by this poisoning effect of silicon on the surface of the ferrihydrite. Now, very quickly moving to the next to last topic, lead. We've done a lot of studies of lead, one of the major pollutant elements that comes from mainly galena, the main source of lead on Earth. We've done studies of the way that lead adsorbs to the surface of different surfaces of aluminum oxide as well as iron oxide. And this shows a discovery we made some years ago. We could actually see outer sphere lead on the surface of aluminum oxide, the 0001 surface, that is the plane perpendicular to the C-axis. And that's shown here. All of the other surfaces show inner sphere lead bound like this. We've done studies of the adsorption isotherms of lead, and you can see clear differences of uptake on alpha Al2O3 versus alpha Fe2O3. Turns out that the most weakly sorbing surface is the alpha Al2O3 surface. The most strongly sorbing surface is the alpha Fe2O3 surface. Again, this points out the importance of iron oxides and sorption reactions for things like lead and, of course, arsenic as well. One of the things that's become very clear recently is that the mineral surface reactivity is determined by the surface structure as well as the surface composition. So we set out to determine that. Here's some STM images by one of our former students, Carrick Eggleston. We joined forces with a theoretical chemist, and she carried out basically what are called ab initio thermodynamic calculations, in which you use density functional theory coupled with thermodynamic data to predict surface energies of various surfaces. And she predicted a surface consisting of about one-third of this sort of material here. Basically, these are singly coordinated oxygens and about two-thirds doubly coordinated oxygens at the surface. Those are the best fits to the data she found. Turns out they were the best fits also for our CTR data, that these are crystal truncation rod diffraction structures that we derived from surface scattering of X-rays, again, at the advanced photon source. And you can see a very clear difference between the surface structure of alpha Fe2O3-0001 and alpha Al2O3-0001. All of these are two-coordinated oxygens. Here you have a combination of two-coordinated and one-coordinated. It's these singly-coordinated oxygens that make the hematite surface so much more reactive than the corundum surface. Here's the result of, again, density functional calculations by Ann Chaka, Tom Trainer, and Sarah Mason. And what they found is that the hematite surface is at least, if not more than four times more reactive than the corundum surface. It's the same basic structure type, but these surfaces differ enormously in reactivity. And we think this is due to the fact that the D-band plays a very, very important role. Finally, just two slides, and I'll be finished and let George take over. The arsenic problem. This is a huge problem. One of my colleagues, Scott Findorf, and his group have been working on this for some time, and some of you in the room here have been working on this as well. Just to show you one last slide here, I now title this the surface chemistry associated with the largest mass poisoning in history. So here's Southeast Asia, here are the Himalayas. It's the arsenic and the pyrite that is the main source of arsenic, which comes down through the various major rivers into the delta here and is deposited, typically in the form of iron hydroxide, such as goethite, with which the arsenic is associated. Bacteria play an important role in reducing both the arsenic as well as the iron in the surfaces of these iron hydroxides. One of the things that Scott's group has just determined, which is rather interesting, is that the bacteria that are present can typically reduce the arsenic at a much faster rate than the iron oxide, than the iron oxide surface. So this is a little bit different than the normal paradigm, but ultimately this arsenic ends up in the drinking water, and one can write a simple reaction like this to explain it. So it's a breakdown of minerals like iron hydroxides that contain adsorbed arsenic, releasing protons, electrons, of course, reducing the iron to Fe2+, and releasing arsenic into the groundwater. So with that, I'd like to stop and thank you for your attention, and I'd like to now turn it over to George.
I'm going to focus on microbial biomineralization and implications for those microbes living in such a highly mineralizing environments. And I'll start with the field study because that's where real life is. although we heard so many talks this morning and beginning of this afternoon already showing, because part of my talk, sorry, the title is Significance of Biomineralization Processes in environmental processes. So we already heard a lot about the importance of microbes and life in those processes. And I just have one additional illustration of this. This study was done in the south of France at the Carnoulles site, which is an acid mine drainage. So that's where Carnoulles is located. And this is one picture of the field upstream, showing all these nice river or a nice yellow stream. And I come back on that one, how nice it is. And so basically, all these things, all these acid mine drainage results from the oxidation weathering of pyrite, which results in very acidic water with pH of around 3 upstream and very high concentration of metals and for example, and concentration of arsenic up to 300 milligram per liter in that stream. So that's pretty high. If you go downstream of this Regus River, you end up with here. And you can see this nice house, the gardens, on the other side of the river, showing that, okay, they culture things. And here, the arsenic concentration is much lower. And so in those few hundreds of meters or a few kilometers, you completely trap arsenic and so lower the concentration of arsenic by several orders of magnitudes. And you do that by the precipitation of sediments, which are of solids, minerals, that are rich in arsenic. And so that study by Guillaume Morin and collaborators shows the different mineral phases that form along the stream, and how this can explain a trap of arsenic. And so you have upstream, you have some this kind of phases. I'll come back on that one, which are composed of, all the phases are iron-rich phases, and so they can contain arsenic under the 3+ form with this tulleyite mineral, or on arsenic under the 5+ form, which give an amorphous mineral, and eventually you end up with other iron oxide. So really the formation of sediments, of minerals, is responsible for the trapping of arsenic, and a lot of arsenic can be immobilized by the mineral precipitation. Of course, what is the driver? The next question is, what is the driver of mineral precipitation? You can have mineral precipitation just because you have those high concentration of arsenic, iron, and so on, and so you exceed the solubility product of some mineral phases, and that's how it works. But at the same time, when you look at the microbial organism living in those environments, you might expect that at pH 2 or 3 with huge concentration of arsenic, there is no organism living in those environments. But of course, this is not the case. You have many microbes thriving in those extreme environments. And you can try to have a look at what those microbes are able to do by the microbial biology approach, and you realize that some microbes are able to oxidize iron, and so they are able to oxidize iron 2 to iron 3, which combines with arsenic 3 to form tulleyite. So if you have iron 2 oxidizing bacteria, they might be responsible for the formation of this kind of mineral phase, and so by this metabolic indirect process. You also have in that stream, you have microbes that are able to oxidize both iron and arsenic, and in that case you oxidize iron 2 to iron 3, arsenic 3 to iron arsenic 5, and you end up with the precipitation of this iron 3 arsenic 5 amorphous phase. And these are different microbes. So somehow here you can show, and of course I show this reaction because those microbes, or part of these microbes, can use the oxidation of iron or the oxidation of arsenic as an energy source to synthesize organic carbon. So, they live on that. They use the oxidation of those metals or metalloids as an energy source. So the interesting thing here is that different microbes can lead to the precipitation of different minerals. So that shows you why it might be interesting to really couple the classical and non-classical mineralogical studies using X-ray diffraction and X-ray absorption spectroscopy, just to look at what mineral phases are in there, and at the same time, use molecular biology tools to look at what microbes are in those environments, what they are doing, and understand how those microbes impact the formation of minerals. And so when you do that, of course, you can really describe diversity of the minerals and at the same time describe the diversity of the microbes living in these environments and try to connect them together. Our approach was to look at those samples and develop some microscopy, a microscopy approach. So basically, okay, we have some idea that some microbes might oxidize iron or oxidize arsenic, and that might induce the precipitation of minerals. But that's always interesting if you can see it with your own eyes. And so we used a combination of microscopies like synchrotron-based microscopy that I'll tell you very quickly about this thing. So this is a Stixom scanning transmission X-ray microscopy and also transmission electron microscopy. And so just because you might not be familiar with this synchrotron-based microscopy, this is a transmission microscopy, basically, and you use synchrotron radiation as a light source. And we focus X-ray beams on your sample and raster the sample and just look at the sample in transmission. And so with this kind of microscopy, the interesting thing is, of course, you can do images. That's a microscope. And the spatial resolution is something like 20-25 nanometer. So this is a bacterium cell. So you have enough pixel, you know, to see nicely the shape of the microbes and different parts in the microbes. And at the same time, with this microscopy and at the same spatial resolution, you can do an X-ray absorption spectroscopy and have some insight on the speciation of carbon, iron, and arsenic. So you can have this information that is of interest, what kind of carbon you have in the bacterium, and what is the redox state of iron, and what is the redox state of arsenic. And so that's just what we did on the cannulus samples. And the first thing we tried to do is just to look at the redox state of arsenic in the samples and try to recognize the arsenic 3 and arsenic 5 phases. And this can be easily done because here you have some reference spectra of arsenic 3 here in green and arsenic 5 compounds in red. And you see that the spectra, basically, they look different. So it's very easy here now on this picture to take a spectrum for each pixel and then try just to look at what is the right spectrum for each pixel of this image. So you can map arsenic 3 and arsenic 5 in that cluster of minerals. And so you see some of this little pocket of arsenic 5 phases and arsenic 3 phases otherwise. On exactly the same location, you can map bacteria using carbon spectroscopy. And in that case, you can image very easily. Just taking two images, you can image the microbes in those clusters of minerals. And you see here one microbe, another one, another one. And from those studies, trying to correlate the redox state of arsenic and the distribution of bacteria, it's really difficult to see any correlation between arsenic redox state and specific microbes. So basically, the idea that some microbes might be responsible for the formation of arsenic 3 phases or responsible for the formation of arsenic 5 phases is difficult to assess by microscopy because this is not just a direct interaction. I mean, this is an indirect metabolic activity, and even if you have one microbe here that is able to oxidize iron 2 into iron 3, iron 3 might precipitate away from this microbe. So that's limited here. However, those microbes, they are not just catalyzer, or they are not just redox catalyzers. They also provide nucleation sites for minerals. And these are cross-sections that we prepare, very thin cross-section, less than 100 nanometer thick. in the cannula samples. And here you observe different microbes. There is this filament here, or those spheres, microbial spheres. And so they are. So we are looking through them. And basically, the dark areas here are electron-dense phases, and they are mineral phases. And they are iron and arsenic-rich phases. And what you can see here is that the minerals form around the microbes. I mean, around, outside, or in the cell wall of those microbes. So this is another way that the microbes are really impacting the precipitation of minerals. They provide nucleation sites, and minerals eventually precipitate on microbes. The second thing you can observe here, I mean, even if you don't know who is there, what kind of microbe is here, there, and so on, you can see that there are some kind of different diverse patterns of biomineralization. For example, if you take this filament, of course, you see some needles here coming out of the microbe. You can see some cell wall, very dense cell wall, and you can see those kind of vesicles emerging from the cell. Here you have two layers. It seems that you have a very thick layer and a laminated layer within. So those two microbes, they seem just to precipitate those minerals differently. So that's another question, another issue. Why do you have different microbes that eventually lead to different patterns of biomineralization? What explains that? Another way that microbes can impact the biomineralization, so the precipitation of minerals, is by producing some extracellular organic compounds. And that's what we figure out looking still at cannula samples. So here we still use this synchrotron-based microscopy, and we map the organic carbon in the sample. So here you have many particles, and you see the very bright spot, they correspond to microbial cells, so very rich in organic carbon. But here, although you don't have bright spots, you don't have microbial cells, you still see some faint white areas, indicating that you have organic carbon that is associated with the mineral phases everywhere. And you can get spectra of the organic carbon associated with the mineral precipitates, and you see that there is some organic carbon, pretty complex, with different functional groups, organic functional groups, associated everywhere with the particles, mineral particles. So in the cannula samples, when you consider the cannula samples, you have all those very tiny arsenic and iron-rich minerals, and all those grains are associated with some organic carbon that we think are produced extracellularly by the microbes that you see here. And of course, if now all these mineral phases are associated down to the nanometer scale with organic polymers, this might have significant impact on their sedimentation properties or maybe surface reactivity. So that's another way microbes can impact mineral precipitation and mineral reactivity. Last thing that we observed, just by looking at the samples, a very weird one, and that might remind of Ruben, the pictures that Ruben showed this morning. So here, this is SEM, scanning electron microscopy picture, and you can, okay, you have the mineral precipitates, and you have some microbial cells here, those rod-shaped forms, and you have those tiny round spheres that are something like 100 nanometer wide. And now we can observe them by transmission electron microscopy, and they are here. So those nice hollow spheres, which are, and you know, they are dark because they are rich in iron and arsenic. So iron and arsenic precipitated on those hollow spheres. Now, if you take a cross-section of these samples, you can see here bacterial cells, and you can see also some hollow spheres coming out from the bacterium cell. So our idea is that those microbes might be able, and that has been shown in many other studies, but not related with mineral precipitation, but some microbes are able to evaginate outer membranes and produce some vesicles. And those vesicles might impact the precipitation of mineral phases. Okay, so what do we learn from this kind of study? Microbe and mineral precipitation, there can be an indirect role of microbes in the precipitation of minerals by the metabolic activity microbes can oxidize iron, they can oxidize arsenic, and that leads to the precipitation of iron-arsenic-rich phases. At the same time, microbes can also provide nucleation surfaces for minerals. Either they are cell walls, and then they get encrusted by minerals, or they can produce extracellular polymers that might also impact the precipitation of mineral phases, or they can produce vesicles. What needs to be further studied? First of all, I showed you very quickly different biomineralization patterns. It seems that different microbes show different way of precipitation, of precipitating minerals, and how does it come like that? Second, of course, what are the mechanism of these biomineralization processes? What is really the importance of microbes? Does it involve some specific biomolecules produced by the microbes, or is this just a passive role, just passive precipitation of minerals on the microbial structures? Finally, and to me it's not the less important question, how bacteria deal with mineral precipitation? When you think about the encrusting of the cells, is it lethal or is it beneficial? And are there adaptive responses to mineral precipitation? And for this, I mean, just very trivial ideas. Why could it be lethal? Just because you have mineral precipitation on microbial cells, this might disrupt the membranes, this might limit also the nutrient transfer between the microbes and the environment. And some people have proposed that some microbes are able to localize precipitation outside so that they won't get encrusted, and so they develop some strategies to limit precipitation within the cells. At the same time, precipitation might be advantageous. When you think about, this has been proposed in some serious journals, when you think about having a microbe precipitating iron oxide very close to the cell, you have production of H+, and eventually the microbes might use gradient of H+ as some kind of energy fuel. Same time, you can, by being encrusted, you might be protected against antibiotics or radiation or desiccation or trace metals. And finally, I mean, there are definitely some examples where we know that some microbes form minerals within the cells, like magnetotactic bacteria. They form those chains of magnetite within the cells to have some magnetic sensing of the environment, and so they really use that. So that's the kind of questions we have. And of course, we have nice pictures with field studies, and we can really dream and have all those theories and hypotheses, but somehow we need to go back to simpler system and go back to the lab. And that's what we did with this system, neutrophilic iron oxidizing anaerobic bacteria. So those bacteria are able to oxidize iron 2 in iron 3 at pH 7 without any oxygen around. So they can use reduction of nitrate, or they can do photosynthesis, so reduce CO2 in the presence of light. Problem with this is that iron 3 is highly insoluble at pH 7. So that's the dilemma. They use this to produce as a source of energy, but at the same time, there is a precipitation of minerals on the structures. And we have looked at two different strains, one called BOFEN1, which is a nitrate-reducing bacterium. So it oxidizes iron 2 into iron 3 and reduces nitrate into something. And it encrusts itself. So the cells got encrusted by the minerals. At the same time, we have another strain, which is doing something different, but we culture them in the same medium, exactly the same culture medium, same environment. But these cells don't get encrusted in minerals. So one is encrusted, the other one doesn't, although they are cultured in the same medium, and they do exactly the same reaction, somehow. What's the difference? Why are they behaving differently regarding to the mineral precipitation? So we looked at more carefully at BOFEN, and basically I just show you the bottle. So this is the beginning of the culture. You have this is clear. You have iron 2, soluble iron 2 here, and then it gets oxidized, turns to green, then to orange. So you can see iron oxidized in the presence of the microbes, and they don't get you don't see this this change of color when you don't add the microbes. So the question, of course, is where is iron 2 oxidized? Where does iron 3 precipitate? And for that, we used, again, microscopy. And here we used transmission electron microscopy. And here the bright areas are just iron-rich areas. So everything that is white here is iron. And you can see different type of precipitate. Some iron precipitate form outside the cells. You have three cells here. Some form outside the cells. Some form around the cell. You have some kind of layer forming around the cell. And some form on the cells. And when you cut those microbes, this is what you can observe. Those cells have two membranes. They are gram-negative bacteria, so they have two membranes, an inner plasmic membrane and an outer membrane. And the volume that is within those two membranes is called periplasm. And here, iron, so in dark you have iron-rich phases, so iron precipitated in the periplasm, in the cell wall of the microbes. You can follow the redox iron redox with at the same scale using scanning transmission X-ray microscopy, and this is at the beginning of the culture. So basically, you have mostly iron 2 rich precipitate, and then with time, you get to iron 3 precipitate. And what you see is that iron 3 appears first on the cells. So, okay, bacteria can oxidize iron 2 and iron 3. You can even quantify these things, and you can distinguish extracellular precipitate and bacteria. And what you can see here is that iron on the bacteria is always more oxidized than iron on the extracellular precipitate, which means that really you have more iron 3 around the bacteria than in the precipitate. So this is probably iron gets oxidized on or in the cells. We did some cryo transmission electron microscopy to have further insight on the different steps of mineral precipitation. And here, this is the first step of the precipitation. So you see the two membranes that I told about. So they are here and here, and the periplasm in this white area. So the precipitation starts here, those very dense areas here. The precipitation starts on the inner membrane. Then iron precipitates get bigger in the periplasm, and so they invade the periplasm, and they are not connected all the way in the periplasm, but you see different patches of iron-rich minerals in the periplasm, and eventually the cell gets completely encrusted in the iron precipitate. Just quickly, just a map showing that some cells, so iron is in red, proteins are in blue. Some cells don't get encrusted, they are only blue. Some cells get encrusted, you see the iron-rich layer around the cells, but still you still have proteins left within these cells. And that's quite an interesting thing, because now you have cells that got encrusted by minerals. So somehow you might call them fossils. No, you replace a microbe by minerals, so that's a fossil. And if you don't dissolve those minerals, you might preserve those things for million years. But at the same time, you also get some organic carbon preserved within those fossils, and that might be an interesting tool for people looking at old rocks. So where is iron 2 oxidized? Probably within the periplasm, as I showed you. Sometimes it gets oxidized also outside the cells. Where does iron 2 precipitate? In this case, for this strain, it clearly precipitates within the periplasm first, and then outside, and then at the surface of the cell. So is encrustation of these cells lethal? These are very basic experiments that we did, and we still need to go further, but trying to understand to this trivial question. If you look at the biomass with time in the culture, so basically we follow the amount of organics, of proteins, a long time in a culture. When you don't add iron, okay, the cell grows typically with an exponential growth phase, then a plateau. When you add iron, it's exactly the same. You have an exponential phase, then a plateau. It seems that iron doesn't really affect, from that point of view, the growth of those microbes. So if you look at the percent of encrusted cells with time, after one day, most of the cells are completely encrusted by iron minerals. And one day it's here, so you see you are still in the exponential phase. So from that, I would say that incrustation doesn't do anything to the viability of those microbes. They are still able to divide, and that's why you have this exponential phase curve. Now, if you, instead of looking at the amount of proteins that is produced, you look at the viability. So this is somehow the number of viable cells that you have in a culture, a long time. After one day, it's from 0 to 1 day, you have increasing of the number of viable cells. So that tells you exactly the same thing. Those cells are viable, although they are encrusted. But after 1 day, it seems that the viability really gets down. So many cells start dying. And this is here, on the plateau. You still keep a lot of proteins because somehow the proteins are trapped within the fossils. So even though you have precipitation minerals, you keep proteins, so you keep that constant. But the viable cells are just decreasing. So the answer to this question is incrustation lethal? Might be no in the first step, and yes after some time. We have no clue why and how. So I won't dwell on this, but that was the second strain, the one that doesn't get encrusted. And these are other pictures showing that this is a TM picture on a cross-section, showing that the cells, this time you see the precipitate, iron precipitate are outside the cells, and the cells doesn't get encrusted. There's no mineral precipitation in the periplasm. And what we could see is that those cells here, so this is the carbon map. You have one cell here, and some kind of extracellular polymer outside. So carbon is everywhere here. But when you look at the iron map, iron is not present on the cell. It's only present on the extracellular precipitate here. Now, the interesting thing is that when you look at the iron redox state of this iron, along those filaments, those extracellular polymers, we could evidence some gradient of the iron redox. So when you go from the cell away from the cell, this is the iron redox, iron 3 over iron 2 total. When you go from the cell to away from the cell, you have decrease of iron 3. So those minerals are more oxidized than those ones. Those minerals are more oxidized than those ones. So you can see the gradient around the cells that is fossilized by those precipitates. Again, we have no clue of how it forms. We have several hypotheses, but okay. So diverse patterns of biomineralization, we still have no clue of whether there is a genetic basis for that or not, but definitely we have two different strains, two different species, and two different completely patterns of biomineralization. I would like to finish with this slide, so it's telling you that bacterial biomineralization is, of course, not limited to iron minerals. It's not limited to acid mine drainages, and it's not even limited to modern Earth. Looking at those processes in bacteria, trying to figure out whether there are some evolutionary basis for those biomineralization patterns might be of interest for people looking at very old rocks. For example, there are some rocks that we suspect, for which we suspect the involvement of microbes in their formation, like those are huge sedimentary deposits of iron 2, iron 3 minerals, banded iron formation. Of those stromatolites here that we think are among the oldest traces of life on Earth, but we have still no clue of how microbes can form such features. Finally, as Gordon mentioned this morning, there are also some minerals that can be pathogenic and they can be caused by some microbes and involved in pathogenic disease. And again, we have not even a clue whether all this always how those calcifications are related to microbes or not. So again, those questions can have a very wide environments and implications. So I'll finish with this. We have still many open questions, and I hope I could show you how we need to couple mineralogy and geochemistry and molecular biology tools to address those questions. And I will thank all the co-authors and people involved in that work. And thank you for your attention.
C'était Karim Benzerara, chargé de recherche au CNRS, à l'Institut de minéralogie et de physique des milieux condensés, et Laurent Charlet, géochimiste de l'environnement, au laboratoire de géophysique interne et technophysique de Grenoble. Tous les deux intervenaient dans le cadre du colloque minéralogie environnementale qui se déroulait en septembre 2009 à l'Académie des sciences. Pour en savoir plus sur cet événement, nous vous invitons à consulter le site de l'Académie des sciences. Et puis bien sûr, nous vous invitons à poursuivre l'écoute des communications en téléchargeant la deuxième retransmission. Vous y retrouverez les interventions de Sabine Petit, Rod Ewing et François Guyot. Merci de votre écoute et à bientôt pour de prochaines retransmissions.